Hi, Patrick Cox here with another World in Words podcast. And here's a familiar scene in today's America. I've witnessed it plenty of times. If you live in the US, I'm sure you have too. It's a young boy or a young girl taking the lead in his or her family, talking to the teacher or the nurse or the police officer. And they're talking, of course, in English, which is the language that the parents struggle with. You must have seen that in a store or at the movies, all over the place. This language gap arises because, of course, the kids go to school and they learn in English. Most of them do anyway. But their parents, they don't. They don't go to school. They have life to get on with. It may even be a life where they don't need much English. But when the language gap grows, some parents do try to do something about it. They do go back to school, a sort of a school anyway, ESL, English as a second language. The key for them is often if they can find a place to learn that's convenient, close to work or home, also at a good time. There aren't many of these courses that fit those criteria. But my colleague Monica Campbell, she's the immigration editor here at the World Public Radio program, she found one.
I heard about a teacher who was offering a class in a community center in Mountain View, California. And we're talking about less than a mile from Google, the Google headquarters in Mountain View. And she told me about this class that she taught and that all of her students were immigrant parents. And they all had young kids who attended one of two elementary schools or preschools near the class. So it was a satellite classroom. And she was teaching this class, and I decided to drop in and take a look.
We're going to play in the park.
English as a second language class.
Everyone, we're
going to play in the park.
Quang Dang from Vietnam is here with about 10 other students, all new to America, all parents with young kids. Their teacher, Kit Miller, says the parents are here to try and catch up because their kids are learning English faster than they are.
That's a source of frustration for the parents because they are losing time every day. And every day that they're here, their kids are learning to be Americans. But they don't really have the opportunity to be Americans in the same way that their kids are.
Another reason why they're here is just to ask basic questions at their kids' schools.
The number one question, how is my child behaving?
It's a language gap that can also keep these parents from getting involved with things like the PTA. Patricia Baquedando Lopez, a professor at UC Berkeley School of Education, says schools may communicate in English, but there are more and more non-English speaking families. She drilled this point home recently when she met with a group of immigrant parents. She said to them,
"Do you realize what this means? That your child is the majority student population at the school?" And the mothers were like, "I didn't know that." And they started thinking that none of us is on the PTA, you know, that's right.
Paquedando Lopez does say she is seeing more efforts to integrate immigrant parents. Some schools are holding separate PTA meetings in Spanish, for example, but tight school budgets make efforts like this rare.
It's good for the kids to get outside in nature.
So the pressure falls on parents to learn English, and not until you try and learn English in the U.S. do you realize it's not easy. ESL classes like this at local community centers are vanishing. When state budgets tighten, like California's did during the recession, ESL classes get chopped and don't really come back. It's like this nationwide. Quang Dang's thankful for his ESL class and is improving word by word.
I like to take the kids there every day.
After class, I go with Quang to the preschool to pick up Queenie, his 4-year-old daughter. Quang hangs back, away from the classroom and other parents. Zero interaction. After, we go to Quang's house in a mobile home park. It's close to Google's massive headquarters, but in that short distance, everything changes. It's a heavily immigrant area. And inside his home, I see Quang's wife, Thuy, working at her kitchen table. She's sewing numbers and names on the back of hockey jerseys for the San Jose Sharks, the kind for sale at the stadium's gift shop. I thought this was something done at a factory, but here she was making them, $9 an hour. She studied English once too.
I study 5 or 6 months, that's it.
But then she stopped.
Because I have the baby.
She had her daughter Queenie and then had to work. The idea now is that her husband, Kwong, can try and learn English. It's all worth it because they say Queenie is getting a better education here than in Vietnam. As for Queenie, she's shy about talking to me in English, but does get excited when her dad pulls out the book he's reading for his ESL class, a kid's book. They sit on the couch and practice.
Dog.
Duck.
Cat.
Cat.
They're pretty much at the same level for now. You know Queenie is going to zoom ahead. And her dad's progress? Well, learning English is getting tougher. The ESL class he was just in got canceled. Tight budgets, not enough students. When I called the other day to see if he'd found another class, he said he hadn't found anything yet, but he's looking. For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, Mountain View, California.
Okay, Monica, so there's this Vietnamese guy who's going to these classes and he's learning a little bit also from his daughter. But I imagine that everybody who goes to these ESL classes has got, each of them have got a different reason for being there.
Absolutely. Actually, he was the only parent from Vietnam. The rest of the adult students in this ESL class were from Latin America, primarily Mexico. And one of the women I talked to, she was from a central part of Mexico, and her young daughter, she was telling me that her young daughter, who has special needs, is in a public school in California. And the reason she was taking and so determined to take this English class was to be able to communicate on the most basic level with the school, the teachers, the principals about her daughter and how her daughter was doing. And she was so distraught about this disconnect that, you know, she was just trying to ask, how is my daughter doing? You know, and not
and,
only
and
that.
And they're all English speakers, all predominantly English speakers.
All predominantly English speakers. Of course, as we heard in the story, there is interpretation provided at schools, but you have to schedule it. There's no spontaneity when it comes to conversing right. between these parents and the schools and the teachers. So in case of an emergency or in the case of this mother with a special needs child, there's no sort of constant check-in that most, I think, native-born parents here in the United States would take for granted or get very frustrated if they couldn't do as much as they wanted.
Right. And how has this changed over time? How were things in the past compared to now as regards why people wanted to take these classes in the past?
Well, I think that there was a higher availability of these classes in the past. I mean, one simple reason is that there was less of a demand. But I also think that as we've seen more immigrant groups become more organized and empowered, that there's more education among immigrant groups, realizing that this is something that they not only should have available, but should demand. At the same time, we still see that there's a big gap between the ability of some immigrant groups to lobby for themselves and to advocate for themselves in the halls of power and those, you know, to say, hey, education minister or education secretary, make more money available for these types of programs. I still see that that's where we're seeing the lobbying power of these particular groups fall short. And as a result, we're not seeing a concerted nationwide effort in the U.S. to make classes like this, adult ESL, available in a more structured way.
Well, it was a great shame. I mean, there's clearly a huge need for it. And for teachers, there's just got to be the most tremendous satisfaction in teaching a bunch of, especially when it comes to adults, people who choose to learn the language.
Well, my father was a principal of an elementary school. In fact, he was my own teacher and principal. Mm. But at nights, he would volunteer to teach ESL, and he always called it the champagne of teaching because even though he taught for free as a volunteer, the students he found were so incredibly appreciative of him being there and helping organize this class, and they knew exactly why they were learning. So, you know, he would come back from those classes, I remember really distinctly, just brimming, you know, with stories right. and just very excited. And you know, that class that he taught, I remember it was a small community center near our home, which is a heavily Latino neighborhood in San Jose, California. That class was cut.
And that's a classic spot for it to be, right in the community.
Right. It was where people worked. It's where people lived. You're talking about people who, are, you know, perhaps don't have the documentation to get a car or they're having to get by on buses or by foot.
How come it was cut?
Well, this was a volunteer effort, so this was something that's really grassroots. It's very individual. Somebody makes a space open. I think it was in the back of a bakery. I mean, these are not formal classes. Now we're starting to see ESL classes become more concentrated at the community college level, and that seems to be something that makes sense. At the same time, community colleges can be just that bit of distance too far for some parents to be able to go on a regular basis. So, for example, the class that I observed in the story that we just heard is literally within walking distance or a couple of bus stops from where these parents' kids go to school or where they work. So they could fit it in. But if it's even just a couple miles more away, that makes it unattainable.
Right. So there's like two things going on. I mean, there's groups of people who are desperate to learn English just in order to do basic things like interact with the teacher and get on with their daily lives. But there is also, especially in California and in Texas and other places, there are whole parts of those states where you can quite happily exist in Spanish in particular and never really leave that bubble. You can do pretty much everything that you need to do in those languages. Does that mean then that there's less of a demand for ESL in some of those places that are heavily Spanish speaking, for example?
There could be less of a demand, but I think that that's when we take away the choice that people can make on their own of whether to learn another language or not. So in California, sure, you can exist in Spanish your entire life in California, and you can get by. And for example, there are PTAs where PTA meetings conducted in Spanish or with translators. At the same time, that meeting happens one day after the meeting with all of the other parents who speak English. So that, in a way, kind of makes that group of Spanish-speaking parents invisible.
You feel like second-class parents in a way.
Well, I think that that also means that they can't advocate in that same room with everybody else the issues that they care about that may be completely different than the issues for those native-born parents. But if it happens in California, it doesn't mean it happens in a place like Alabama. It doesn't mean it happens in a place like Georgia. And we're seeing larger Latino populations move into places like that. So while it's great that you can live and exist and thrive in Spanish in California, it doesn't mean that that's the way it is for the rest of the country or that's the way it always will be.
Monica Campbell, she is The Big Show's immigration editor. Now for a bit more Spanish from somebody else who, like Monica, is bilingual Spanish-English in America. She's Joy Diaz. She's a reporter in Austin, Texas with radio station KUT. She's also a mom who learned a little bit more about Spanish from an Arabic speaker she met in Austin. Here's Joy.
Rehab Masif was my daughter's preschool teacher in Austin. Masif is from Lebanon. As a little girl, Camila, my daughter, spoke mostly in Spanish, and Masif remembers a day when Camila was frustrated because she couldn't remember a word in English.
She was telling me about her camis.
Camisa is the word in Spanish for shirt. And Masif understood it perfectly, because camis means the same thing in Arabic.
And I was like, oh, there's some words related, you know, to the Arabic.
To see just how many, Masif and I did an exercise. I'd say a word in Spanish, and she'd say it back in Arabic.
Aceite.
Oil.
Zeit.
Similar spelling and pronunciation.
Guitarra.
Guitar.
We say guitar.
Now that I'm aware, it seems like I hear Arabic words everywhere. Take, for instance, one of my favorite songs by Latin Grammy winner Juan Luis Guerra. Ojalá que llueva café is peppered with words like café, coffee, and ojalá, God willing, both come from Arabic. Or take late salsa singer Celia Cruz's catchword, azúcar, or sugar, another Arabic word.
Azúcar.
Linguist Victor Solís Parejo from the University of Barcelona in Spain says part of the language Spanish speakers use is the legacy of the influence of the Moors. That's the Arabic-speaking group from North Africa that invaded what would become Spain back in the 8th century. Their influence lasted about 700 years and is still visible today.
Especially if you travel south Spain, for example, in Merida, in the city where I was born, we have the Alcazaba Arabi, which is an Arabic fortification. So you can see that in the cities nowadays, but you also can see that Islamic presence, that Arabic presence in the language.
And of course, that presence traveled to the Americas when the Spaniards came here. About 4,000 Spanish words are believed to come directly from Arabic. That's why Maria Gutierrez, a Mexican aid worker with a nonprofit in Jordan, says she carries with her a small notebook wherever she goes.
Yeah, I'm trying to track all those words. It's like, oh, one more word. Like, at least every day I will find a word like, oh, it's exactly the same in Spanish. Oh, it's very close to Spanish.
The sooner Gutierrez masters the language, the sooner she'll be effective with her aid work. And right now, being able to speak Spanish is giving her a shortcut. But why should this merger of Spanish and Arabic matter to Americans? Well, the two most spoken languages in the U.S. are English and Spanish. So what could happen to these languages as time goes by? Linguist Solís Parejo.
I believe that languages are alive.
Languages adapt and borrow words from each other, especially languages that live in close proximity.
I still remember when I first came to Texas, and, you know, I went to this restaurant with my wife, and the waiter asked us, do you want to have dinner inside or you want to go to the patio? I've never heard that word before in English, right? And it was like, where? Yeah, sir, outside. And I say, oh, en el patio. Yeah, let's go to the patio.
Patio is a Spanish word that entered the English language in the early 19th century. If the influence exists to the point that we often joke about the existence of Spanglish, imagine what Americans will be speaking in, say, 100 or 200 years.
Joy Diaz is a reporter with KUT in Austin, Texas. And that's it for the show. We have photos of some of the people in Joy's story. Also, some from Monica's ESL story. They're at pri.org/language. We're on Facebook at the World in Words page. And wherever you listen to this podcast, whether it's iTunes or Stitcher or Overcast or wherever else, please give us a review. It really helps to get out the word. Tweet me too if you want to get in touch. For any reason, well, for most reasons, my handle on Twitter is Patricox, PatriCox. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Soundworks.
Soundworks
from PRI. Oh.